Welcome to Flowcast. I'm Sister Beth Murphy. With me today are Sister Sharon Zayak, the co-founder of Jubilee Farm, and an internationally sought-after speaker on eco-spirituality, and Father Richard Chiola, a retired priest of the Diocese of Springfield in Illinois, who taught graduate theology, is a therapist, and a historian of theology. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sister Sharon and Father Richard have written a book together, recently published, and they're here to talk with us about it. The book is titled Science and Christ, a Dialogue, and they have a touching story about how they came to be collaborators on this project. So can we begin with that? Would you like to tell us the story of why it is that you two decided to collaborate on the book?
Well, the story is actually part of the acknowledgments at the introduction of the book. And it says there that Sister Sharon had been giving a program on cosmology to some of the Dominican sisters. And towards the end of the presentation, one of them asked something along these lines: can you elaborate a bit more on how Jesus and we are different, since Jesus and we are both human and divine? And Sister said she needed to ponder that question, as most of the people in the work of theology and cosmology continued to ponder the question. So I had gone to see one of the other Dominican sisters, Sister Anne Regina, and she suggested that since I wanted to write about that topic, this pondering that was going on between cosmology and theology, that I should collaborate with Sister Sharon. And that's how we got together.
So it was Sister Anne Regina who was the instigator of the book.
As usual, Sister Anne Regina was the instigator, and that's why we dedicated the book to her.
That's lovely. And she only died relatively recently at a very advanced age. So we trust that she is with all of us as we move forward in the conversation. As I read the book, which I thoroughly enjoyed and found much to contemplate, one of the questions that came to me was, for whom did you write the book? Who were you thinking about as you were writing? And I'd love to hear you discuss that.
Since I'm the primary writer of the book, and I collaborated with Sister Sharon around the issues of cosmology and environmental issues, I think she ought to address what that audience primarily is like, because I had additional audiences in mind.
One of the questions we get most often, those of us who speak and write about cosmology, is how does this fit with our Christian faith? How does it fit with our understanding of Jesus and the Christ? And that theology is only yet being written. There aren't too many theologians who are really taking this up. The few that are giving us a lot of things to think about. I think of Elizabeth Johnson. I think of Sally McFaig, an Episcopal theologian who has recently died. Dennis Edwards, an Australian priest who has written quite a bit about Christ. Even Raimon Panikkar, who is a priest and theologian who also has recently died. So when we speak about, cosmology, that term itself is even misunderstood. And I'm not digressing. I think this is important for us to say that cosmology is a comprehensive look at our understanding of how the world functions, how it works, what makes it up, what makes it do what it does. And it is primarily science that teaches us that. So it is the science of the unfolding evolutionary story of the universe and of Earth and of life. But cosmology also encompasses story and human traditions and culture and our ponderings of who is in charge of the whole thing. So when we look at the story of cosmology, we're looking at how to understand the universe and Earth in a multidisciplinary fashion. And so those of us who are teaching cosmology are teaching not just the science, but the human cultural story that goes with it and the religious story. And for many Christians especially, it's because it has been part of our education, it's been very difficult to understand how our understanding of the Christ fits into all of it. So this book is written for all of us who are taking that cosmological journey and understanding how our faith comes from that understanding. And then Richard had another view of who he was writing for. So Richard, I'll let you respond to that.
Yes, I actually had in mind my great niece, who is a high school student, going into senior year of high school here at SHG in Springfield. She loves science and mathematics. And I have often wondered if she would be able to take in more about her religious background as a Catholic Christian, if she could put that science and mathematics together with what we believe about Jesus Christ and about God who missioned him into the world for our salvation. So that's the kind of audience I had in mind. And when Father Donald Gergen wrote his introduction, he touches on this, that some of the people reading the book would be interested in the science more, and other people would be interested more in the Catholic faith or Christian theology aspect of it. And it would be interesting to get those two sides together. I think most people of faith tend to think of cosmology the way it's most often in the media, which is strictly science. So, and oftentimes with a denial of the need for God or of the very existence of God, and that's not necessary. What Sister Sharon just explained, that there are many people who are putting together the story that science tells us about the universe, along with the human experience of it, and along with the way in which believers of various religions can put that together as a whole. So in the book, I reference this by saying that initially, it seemed to me anyway, that cosmology started out as a science of the universe, and then it has gradually, especially in the last half century, become much more welcoming to sociology, to psychology, and to religion especially.
Thank you so much. You know, when you mentioned your niece, Father Richard, I remembered so many conversations that I've had over the years with young people, in particularly high school students, who have the erroneous impression that if you are a Christian, you can't believe in science. Well, believe in, you know, in air quotes, you can't believe in science and also be a Christian. And I'm not exactly sure why or how that got started. I have some suspicions, but I don't know for sure. And it seems to me to be a really critical moment in our human history that we help young people understand that. And so what you're saying to me, I think, is that's one of the goals of your writing the book.
This is especially the case because Sister Sharon and I had an ongoing dialogue through the writing of the book. Anything that I would write, she would critique, and then I would rewrite it. And anything that I didn't understand about science, I'd pass by her, and sometimes I was right. And we went back and forth that way, and it's especially important because she started out in her first incarnation in the Dominicans as a good English teacher, and so it was wonderful to have her correcting all the things that I usually get wrong when I'm trying to write, punctuation and spelling and all the rest. And the best part of this was when she would say, "What are you trying to say? I don't think your reader's going to understand this." And we would go back and forth. And it really took us, 2.5 years, something like that, to get this whole thing together. I especially relied upon her for the science part, but I also did my own research on some of the things, especially the Big Bang and black holes and all that kind of thing that you have to have some understanding about when you hear what people say about these things. I'll give you a for instance. At the beginning of one of his book, Carl Sagan, and this is a book my great niece has in her library, says that we don't need God as he goes out and looks at the universe. and immediately wondered, what does that mean, that there doesn't need to be a God? And in the book, I talk about the various ways in which theology and science move back and forth. So sometimes when people are saying we don't need God, they're emphasizing that there are laws in the universe which are self-sustaining. And at other times, they're actually denying faith. Those are two different things. And if we don't take the time to listen more carefully to what each other are saying, we could have people, and we certainly do among Christians, who say that we cannot accept evolution, that the universe is less than 6,000 years old, and we know better through science.
Yes, exactly. You make the point early in your book that science and scripture are asking different questions, that science asks how the cosmos came into being, while scripture asks, why does a cosmos even exist? Is that a fair representation of one of the directions you're going in the book?
I think so. Sister Sharon, what do you think?
I think that whole, and getting back to your previous question, Beth, about why do so many Christians feel that they have to believe either in what scripture says or in what science says. Science and religion both ask questions. Both are seekers. And I think one of the great services that Pope Francis has done in his encyclical, Laudato Si, is to talk about the fact that we have, as humans, two great sources of wisdom. One is science and one is religions. And he makes it plural, because it's not just one religion, it's all religions, all cultures contribute to our understanding of the divine. And that it's not science or faith, it's science and faith. And that we as humans only come to understand the divine through creation, through our created senses. And it is science that helps us understand what creation is and how it works. And it is our faith, our pondering on those in light of our understanding of and our faith in a divine being, that helps us understand better and more intimately who the divine is in relation to this creation that is a manifestation of the divine. And so as we look at these two great sources of wisdom, we need both of them. We need both of them in order to grow in faith and in our understanding of who we are, and especially who we are in relationship to the whole.
We don't dwell on this in the book, but I want to give you a very practical example. That back in the 1200s, St. Thomas Aquinas was using a kind of philosophy, Aristotelianism, that came from a Greek botanist. He was looking, Aristotle, at creation and noticing how it works. And he developed a whole philosophical system on the basis of science, the best of his day. Thomas Aquinas was accused of being suspicious because he was using not only Greek philosophy that was science-based and not just theory-based, but it was Greek philosophy that was being translated by Muslims and held by them until it could be translated into Latin by Christians. And so there was all kinds of suspicion around him. So there's going to be necessarily suspicion whenever you put science and theology together. Why do I say that? First of all, historically, and secondly, because the brain loves to hold on to what it believes it already knows and doesn't like questions put to it by either science or religion. And yet everybody has these questions, but they have to keep them to themselves because otherwise they're going to get in trouble because a lot of other people don't want to hear the questions.
You know, all through this conversation, what's coming to my mind is an essay that I read about truth and the nature of truth from Timothy Radcliffe, who was at one time the master of the Order of Preachers. And in that essay, he talks about the only way to truth, the only way to veritas is through falsity, that we have to give ourselves the space to think wrongly in order to find our way to what we can most easily understand as true. And that makes a lot of people really nervous. So partly inspired by reading your book, I've decided I need to understand more about the science of the universe. And you know what I'm starting with? I'm starting with a book written by Neil deGrasse Tyson called, I think it's called The Science of the Universe for Kids. That's where I'm starting because that's about the level of my understanding. And in that book, he is constantly talking about, well, this is what we think, but we could be really wrong because we don't have the science to back it up yet. And I find that so refreshing. Could we religionists benefit from taking that same attitude?
I think so. And here's the important thing. The title of the book is Science and Christ, a Dialogue. And if you go, first of all, to the Gospels, you're going to see that the apostles were always misconceiving the truth about Christ. He repeatedly talks to them about going to Jerusalem to die, to be buried, to rise again. They can't understand resurrection. Not all Jews believed in it. They certainly couldn't understand crucifixion as a way of him being a Messiah. And that kind of grappling with the falsity in order to come to the truth is what the book really is leading us to, because it starts out by saying neither science nor theology is as absolute as it frequently appears. And the book moves on to talk about how we truly are come to the truth of Jesus Christ, not simply through ideas, but through encounter. You must know him through some true encounter with him in order to grasp what he says of himself, I am the way and the truth and the life.
You know, so often we humans want answers. And so we'll hold on to something that sounds like a good answer, and then that becomes our answer, and we don't want to listen to anything more. And I've come to understand more and more the older I get and the more I learn, which shows me the less I know, that it's not about answers, because so often the answer we have is only the answer for right now, because we always get more information. We always get new understanding. And so it's not the answer that is important. It's the questions. It's the questions we ask. And I really think it's by the questions we ask and the questions that are put before us, that leads us deeper and deeper into holy mystery and deeper into understanding. But that's really hard for people, isn't it? They want an answer. They want the answer. And they'll say, so what's the answer? And many times I have to say, there is no answer. There are only more questions.
Well, this is what the real direction of the book. It starts with this question, how is Jesus different than us and yet the same as us? How are we both human and divine like him? That's the essential question of Christianity, really. And as that unfolds, we begin to see, especially in the last chapters of the book, what Cardinal Ladaria, who was a Spanish Jesuit and the head of the Holy Office or the Office for the Faith in Rome, recently retired, what his whole theology was about. It was about our real fullness is to be as Jesus is now at the right hand of God in the fullness of his glory. That's where not only individual human beings, not only the church, but the whole of creation is being drawn. And that's why the book begins by saying God didn't make creation complete, because God had another idea in mind that through Jesus Christ, it would find its completion in God.
Let's go that direction then, because I think that that's at the heart of what we need to get to. We have this, and you use the word in the book, myth, the creation myth, that God created a perfect universe, a perfect paradise, into which God placed Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve sinned. They did something God asked them not to do. And that is the cause of all death and pain that we experience. But in your book, you talk about that in a very different way. So I think there's two things that have to get unpacked. And the first thing is, what do we mean by myth? Because for many people, that's a scary word. And if we could talk about that, and then we could go on to talk about the creation story a little bit.
Many people are troubled by the word myth because they think it means something that isn't true. Oh, that's just a myth. But the word myth means a great deal more than that. In the book, we use a definition that says, a myth is a story or tradition that claims to reveal in an imaginative way or a symbolic way a fundamental truth about the world and human life. And so, for instance, the myth of the creation of woman in the second chapter of Genesis. Up to that time, there's really no sexuality. Adam stands for the whole of humanity. But like a parent trying to answer a child's question, how come people get married? The myth explains that when God created the woman, he took a rib from the side of Adam near his heart so that Adam could see in the woman his own true self and she could see in him her own true self so that the two could become one. So there's that deeper reality that science alone is not going to be able to get at because it asks the questions, well, how does that happen? Not what is it that's that deeper reality?
Another way to look at myth, two ways that I've always shared, because they're simple, but they're profound. One way is, it's a story, actually, I think it actually happened. There was parents who asked their seven-year-old daughter, do you understand what myth is? And she said, yes, it's a story that's not true on the outside, but it is true in the inside. And then I also read once, and I wish I had the citation for it, but it was a Native American asked to explain myth. And he says, well, it's a way to tell a story. I don't know if it really happened, but it's true.
Yes, I think it was, and again, I'm not going to remember either, but I think it was Sally McFaig who said that all stories are true and some of them really happened. So it's another way to get
right,
at the same
another
point.
Way. Mm-hmm.
Now, today, I think in our culture, we have to deal with the fact that myth does have that sense of not being true because of this whole question of alternative facts and the theories about people undercutting reality and so on and not telling the truth. And so myth gets thrown into that, but that's not traditionally what myth was all about.
No, so myth is a way of getting at a deeper truth that human beings may only be able to grasp minimally.
That's correct.
Or can it only explain it through story? We tell stories to help us understand.
And the reason we do that is because our true understanding comes not through ideas, but through encounters. So you can have all the facts you want, but unless you can encounter the reality of the person or of the thing you're talking about, and that's what story allows us to do, you're not going to come away with the truth that actually satisfies you. And that's where the book moves into that connection with Jesus the Christ and speaks about the language we use to talk about Christ, or what we call Christology, has become the language not of simply statements and facts and ideas, but rather the encounter kind of language. How do you come to know him? How do you come to experience the person of Jesus Christ so that you can place your faith in him?
And the scriptures, whether we're speaking of the Jewish Testament or the Christian Testament, are human attempts to share those deep encounters.
Precisely.
And what the two of you are doing with this book, Science and Christ, a Dialogue, is trying to express what the relationship we have with Christ and the relationship that we have with the creation of which we are a part have to do with each other.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Yes,
it is. It's very fair because, again, in the book, we talk about this long tradition that there are two books by which we can come to encounter God. One is creation. The other is the person of Jesus. Okay? And here's another thing. Other than the science that people might not know that appears in the book or some of the theological material that people might not know that appears in the book, truly, there's nothing in this book that hasn't been printed someplace else. That is to say, this is not new. What it is putting it together in such a way that what most people haven't heard, either about Christ, if they are Catholics or Christians, and they don't realize that what we believe about him has been shaped by people since his time, and that there are other people who would shape that knowledge in a different way, who are also part of our church and its history and of our official theology, or the same way with science, things that we thought we knew about the world, and yet we're finding we don't. I give you a for instance. The book came out in May, right? And within 2 weeks, I saw an article saying, oh, by the way, scientists think that maybe the universe isn't 13.8 billion years old, but 27 billion years old. And I went, well, there goes the book.
Because we're always learning something new.
Exactly.
And, you know, my first inkling that I was kind of raised with this idea that many, many scientists were completely a-religious. But when I was at the University of Edinburgh studying, they had the Gifford Lectures, and the Gifford lecturer was John Polklinghorne, who I think only recently passed away.
Right.
So I dutifully attended all of Father Polklinghorne's lectures and probably understood about 0.1% of what he was saying. What I did learn from him didn't come from the words that he said, but from who he was as a faith-filled person. So he was both an Episcopalian priest and a physicist, and I don't remember what kind. But he was so far beyond me with the science that I was just completely lost all the time. What I understood from him was that he was on a great adventure of faith, and science only informed that for him and gave him such a deep, joyful understanding of his relationship with the Word made flesh, or the Christ, who we now say in a rather, I would dare say, mythical way, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that Word made flesh is the impetus of love out of which the universe came to be. And even though I couldn't understand Dr. Polklinghorne's words, I understood very well with a deep hunger that I could be able to join him in his deeply beautiful understanding of how science informs our faith. And I kind of think that that's what you want to do with your book for people.
I was amazed as I was writing the book how many times I would say, this Catholic priest, this Catholic scientist, and so on, that they were constantly coming into play, as well as the Anglican Archbishop retired from Canterbury now, Rowan Williams, whose Christology I started reading 3 or 4 years ago, wonderfully places his Christology in conversation with cosmology. There were Sally McFage that you mentioned before, and many other authors who are Christians who are doing this same kind of work.
You know, again, it brings me back to something we said earlier. We come to understand the divine through creation. And the more you learn about creation, the more you delve into its incredible intricacy. And you speak about physicists, and you speak about, you know, scientists in very specialized disciplines, that how could they not be amazed? First of all, they're absolutely amazed by what they're learning on a scientific level. But how could you not also be amazed then to know that the God who created all of this is far beyond anything we ever, ever intimated before? And the more we learn from science, the more it teaches us about this creator and about God. So, you know, going back to Pokinghorn, how could you not be excited about what you were sharing?
The book references Rabbi Heschel, who decades ago wrote God in Search of Man, and says in that book that the very first necessary thing, if you're going to be moved to worship, is to raise your eyes up and ask the question, who created all of these things? That's the Bible begins with the act of creation. And as Sister just said, everything that we know about God is mediated through created reality. Even Jesus himself, the incarnation means that the Son of God became man, human being, so that through his humanity, we could come to know more clearly that God is love and has sent his Son that we may have an abundance of life. There's nothing that we can know, it appears, that isn't mediated through creation. Nothing that we can know about God or anything else, because all of our senses are geared to taking in creation and trying to understand it.
And Rabbi Heschel says that our response to all of that is to stand in radical amazement.
Yes, which is what the essence of worship is. It's not checking off that we did the necessary number of hymns, prayers, or time, but that we were actually amazed by God. So when a teenager tells me that Mass is boring, then I know that they haven't caught on to what's happening there at the Mass. And one of the things that we do in this book, certainly I was very interested in doing, is to make the whole context of especially Catholic Christian experience of Christ, the Mass, that's what's at the center. And it's not because we've fulfilled an obligation or again said the right prayers. The Mass is central because there we are offering back to God what God has offered to us. And when we do that and add ourselves to the offering, we receive back the whole Christ, the one who has died and risen and is in glory, and each other who are members of the body. There's a context there where the Eucharist is not simply something reserved in the tabernacle. The Eucharist is this moment of amazement at the way in which everything is one, no matter how diverse, no matter how opposite, no matter how polarized, all things are one because all things are one with God.
That is communion.
Correct.
And I have to say thank you so much to both of you. I wish we had another half hour. We don't. But I think we've probably whetted the appetites of our listeners. So could you tell them where they can find your book?
Yes, Sister Sharon has at least 200 copies, and I have 3, so they can certainly get them from us. The price of the book is $16, but you can also get it on Amazon, Lulu, and you should be able to get it through Barnes & Nobles.
Okay, so if you want to order it from one of those retailers, please do. If you would prefer to get it directly from Sister Sharon or Father Richard, where could they call, Sharon, to order a copy?
They can call Jubilee Farm at 217-787-6927.
And then we can find a way to get them the book. Do they need to be locally in Springfield in order to get that, or can you ship to anywhere from the farm?
I have already been shipping them across the country.
Okay, so there you go. There you have it. And I hope that you sell all 500 and more. And I hope our readers are, that their interest is piqued and that they want to be curious and grow in their faith and in their understanding of science and creation. It's such an amazing time to be alive and to be experiencing this dialogue between our faith and science in the world right now. So thank you so much, Sister Sharon Zayach and Father Richard Chiola. It's been a delight being with you.
Thank you.
This has been FlowCast. The FLOW in FlowCast is an acronym that stands for a line from the Gospel of John, that Jesus gave his life for the life of the world, and we are to do the same. Thank you to my Flowcast team, Brandon Durham, our engineer, and Jean Ann Miller, who is our marketing guru. I'm Sister Beth Murphy. We invite you to check out the Flowcast website page, where you'll find a set of show notes that will point you. I can point you to the farm to get copies of the book. I can point you to some of the other resources that we mentioned in the show. That'll all be in the show notes at flowcastlisten.org. And if you would like to not miss a single episode of Flowcast, at that same website, flowcastlisten.org, you can subscribe to receive each episode of our podcast in your email inbox. So please do that and share the show with your friends. We want to spread the good news. So for Flowcast, Sister Beth Murphy signing out. God bless you all.